So having said all of that, I can think of no one that I personally would rather hear from right now than the gentleman to my right. We were just introduced this morning. I had a little information by way of introduction, but what I was told is let him tell his own story, offer his own views about the war on drugs. And that is, of course, Billy Murphy from Baltimore. Thank you.
Just when hope is dying, you run across the unexpected, which tells you the strength of the human spirit, the resilience of decency as an inherent quality of people, and the role of compassion and understanding in looking down the road ahead. My name is Billy Murphy, William H. Billy Murphy, Jr., from Baltimore, Maryland. My career path is very simple. I was a child of the civil rights movement. My father was the third black person to graduate from the University of Maryland Law School, and he was enrolled by court order. My Uncle George, my favorite uncle, was a member of the Communist Party and would enliven every family discussion with views far left of center. I was an inveterate community organizer from the time I could walk. It was part of my family heritage. It was expected that I would be a foot soldier in the movement and ultimately a general. It was expected that I would run for public office, which I did on several occasions. It was expected that I would take a leadership role in combating white male supremacy. Ultimately, I became a lawyer. My first client was the Black Panther Party. And I moved up in the ranks and ultimately was, at the age of 36, elected to the Circuit Court for Baltimore City. I ran against five incumbents, and I was elected overwhelmingly. That gave me the idea that perhaps I could be mayor of Baltimore just by being a straight shooter. Boy, was I wrong about that. I got whipped 2-1, went back into the practice of law, and I've been doing criminal law mostly for 29 years. I do a different kind of work now, and I've dedicated my remaining years to the battle against drug prohibition, a battle which has become so racist, so counterproductive, so destructive, so awful in terms of what is happening to this country and to its core values, that to me it is the most important fight that can be waged today. And I'm not a naive guy. I've been involved in lots of courtroom activity. I know lots of cops, represented cops, got cops in my family. I've had relatives of all stripes wrongfully arrested. I've been repeatedly rousted illegally. My son, who is a lawyer, has been in addicted upwards of 14, 15 times, just driving while black. And I understand what's going on, but it never ceases to amaze me, and I think I finally figured it out at the ripe old age today of 63. Why there's not even a debate about prohibition in America. First of all, if you look back at the last prohibition, it was a constant debate. The debate was narrowly lost with the Constitutional Amendment. As soon as the Constitutional Amendment passed, the debate quickened. The debate quickened every year after that. Americans were so divided about it, because it criminalized the majority of the American population, as does current prohibition. That debate gathered momentum. voices from all parts of the country could be heard in and out of the law enforcement community. It was essentially an all-white debate because back in those days, black people didn't count for much anything. Let's be clear. Black people were not part of the organization of the movement for prohibition. Black people were not counted as the victims of alcohol abuse. Black people were not counted among the criminalized for alcohol abuse. This was a fight waged homogeneously by white Americans about white Americans for the benefit of white Americans who were being criminalized as white Americans. Now let's segue to the next stage. There was this underground civil rights movement going on at the time. It was not a majority movement. It has never, incidentally, been a majority movement. And all of these black people of African descent in America who were the sons and daughters of the sons and daughters of the sons and daughters of slaves, no longer intimidated by risking their lives back home. That the civil rights movement sprang anew. It had adherents among people of goodwill in the so-called white community. And by the way, just let me give you a footnote here. I abhor race classification. I think it's the dumbest thing that's ever happened in the world. I think no good can come of it remaining. I am not a black man, even though I'm classified as one. You are not white folks, even though you're classified as such. If you internalize your race classification, you are a fool because you have lost sight of the fundamental human dignity which rises above classification of all kind, save perhaps male and female, where there are fundamental differences that cannot be ignored. Oh, Lord, boy, did I just step in it. But I think you know what I'm talking about. And so I think race classification is total and complete bullshit. And the sooner we shed it individually, the better off we'll be. That's why in my more lucid moments, I refer to white folks as people classified as white, and as black people, as people classified as black, etc., etc., because that shows the ridiculous nature of our refusal to shed this irrelevant skin and see the beauty of the individual inside. But back to the point. So, now we're heading into the 60s. And several things happened during the 60s that need to be remembered. First of all, the 60s had a racist structure intact all over the United States. Law enforcement totally segregated. To become a black cop was to become a pariah. You couldn't get promoted. You weren't considered a full-fledged police officer, but you had to be there to legitimize what was going on in the black community. The black community was being policed essentially by white males who had been trained in the Henry Ford tradition. If you will remember, Henry Ford became an industrialist of great power and presence because he understood race in America. He was the last to unionize, and only the Great Depression caused the Ford Motor Company to unionize. You know how he kept from unionizing? He had a three-part workforce. He pretended to be a liberal, but boy, was he cynical. One-third of the workforce was people who had been here for three or four generations, white folks, so-called. The second part of his workforce were immigrants, people who were struggling to become Americans, who were the victims of prejudice, such as the Irish and the Italians and the Jews. And the third part of his workforce were African Americans from Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, who'd come up to Detroit via the Mississippi River for their first opportunity to work in American industrial jobs. And His approach was very simple. This wasn't humanitarianism because he was a deeply racist man. Anytime they'd be in the paint shop, for example, getting their asses kicked by the same toxic fumes because you get a Ford in any color as long as it was black. And you could hear the conversation. Damn, man, these fumes are fucking me up. And that would be the white guy. And then the immigrant guy said, in a barely discernible English dialogue or dialect, he'd say, yes, these fumes are fucking me up. And then the black man would say, these motherfucking fumes are fucking me up. And so they'd be having the same problem. And they would immediately go to the logical solution to the problem. Let's stop these paint fumes. This is dangerous. We're all working under dangerous conditions. Until Henry Ford's men would sneak on in and say to the white guy, look, I saw you talking to that hunky and that nigger. And he'd fall in line. Then they go to the so-called hunky, the immigrant. Hey, man, I saw you talking to that nigger. What were you talking to that nigger about? We don't talk to niggers here, blah, blah, nigger this, nigger that. And he'd fall in line. And then they'd go to the so-called nigger. And they say, nigger, are you crazy? I saw you talking to that white man. Do you want to lose your job? No, sir, boss. And so the show kept rolling. They never could agree on the things they had in common. They were divided on the basis of race and ethnicity. And when I look at the police force that we inherited in the J. Edgar Hoover, who was in his last days when I was growing up in this profession, that's the America I saw. The America where I couldn't go into any neighborhood in Baltimore except a black neighborhood. Where I couldn't go to school in Baltimore except to a black school. And when they had so-called integration, I was the only black in my class in junior high, high school, college, Master's Institute of Technology would only admit 3 blacks a year in an entering class of 900 and some. I was one. I remember the other two. One had a Jewish name, Ernie Cohen. The other was Bill Eagleson. And then law school, only black in my class, in class of 129. I've lived this stuff. I know what happened next. And what happened next was very interesting. You had an explosion of anti-war sentiment. You had an explosion of recreational drug use. You had an explosion of militancy by the black community and by people associated with the movement. It was considered dangerous by 70% of the American white men in this country. They had the power. We were all on the outside. They had the means of jailing. They had the control of the legislative bodies. They had control in every major city in the United States. Many of them were deeply racist. What do you think they would do when they saw an opportunity to control this movement and limit this movement? There were 3 movements: the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and the movement for civil liberties, expressed through recreational drug usage and other kinds of countercultural things. Changes in dress, changes in language, changes in First Amendment utilization. All of this deeply threatening to the white men who held the reins of power in this country. Up until that time, when drugs started to creep into the white community's consciousness, the predominant view was that drug addiction was not a crime. It was a medical problem. It didn't belong in the criminal courts. But when it became useful to view drug addiction and drug crimes as a tool to stop these 3 movements, well, it doesn't take rocket science to understand what happened next. And that was the beginning of the war on drugs. Didn't take long for it to crystallize. We went from a Lyndon Johnson, arguably one of the greatest presidents ever, brought us the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, numerous other civil liberties extensions, things that made America useful to me, enjoyable ultimately on many levels to me. And then came the darkness of Richard Nixon, the beginning of the so-called Southern Strategy. He recognized that all of this civil rights activity, this countercultural First Amendment expression and the anti-war movement inflamed the South. Inflamed the South. And so he said, you're welcome in the Republican Party. You used to be Democrats, so-called Dixiecrats. I now welcome you without any change whatsoever in your philosophical orientation to the Democrat, to the Republican Party. And racism in the political landscape of this country became institutionalized once and for all. We knew how Trent Lott felt before he verbalized that shit. Only a few motherfuckers on the other side of racial divide didn't understand that shit. We understood there was no change whatsoever in the deepest recesses of the psyche of an America that had been conditioned to believe in white male supremacy their entire lives. We knew that laws didn't change how people felt deep down. They haven't yet, and they never will. Other things must happen to make people change how they feel. And one of those things has been the integration of the moneyed classes. One of the few things that gives me hope about what's going to happen in the future. I've watched my son, my three sons, my four sons, and my daughter get educated in substantially integrated environments where they have real friends on the other side of the race divide, things that didn't happen to me when I was growing up. And I see real respect and interchange and an absence of functional racism. But on the lower levels, where most black people live, and this is why we don't have a debate about prohibition. On the lower levels, where most black people live, perhaps 80% of all the black Americans in this country, there is abject poverty. There is increasing economic deprivation because of the addiction to drugs. There's increasing community destruction because of the associated violence. There's increasing political alienation because the system doesn't seem to be responsive to the legitimate desires of these people who are increasingly trapped in rural pockets of America and in the inner cities of America. They do not participate in the debate because their politicians are too afraid of becoming involved. There is an absence of leadership in these communities about why prohibition is vital to returning these communities to full mental, physical, economic, and political health and spiritual health. And so there's no discussion coming from the black community. The community that arguably is getting hurt the worst by this war on drugs. About change. About debate. And when you don't even hear a debate, you don't see movement. You don't feel energy. You don't see the steps that are required for change. Which leads me to an example of where we are. 1996. The National Association of Institutions and Alternatives did a study of Baltimore, my hometown, and they found that there were that year 1,546 serious drug prosecutions in that city. 1,546 prosecutions of PWID, conspiracy, or distribution, or worse. City's 42% classified as white. How many of these serious drug prosecutions, and we're not talking about possession, we're talking about the most serious, How many of these serious drug prosecutions involved white folks? How many say 10%? How many say 20%? How many say 5%? Y'all so wrong. How many say more? You're so wrong. How many say substantially less? All right, you're getting it. How many say greater than 1%? Now you're scared. Less than 1%, 14. If you go to any criminal court in Baltimore, Maryland, any criminal court, as Richard Pryor says, you don't see justice, you see just us. It's undeniable that it's a one-way street to criminality. And I get asked all the time, well, Murph, are you saying drugs should be legalized? I'm saying they're already legalized in the white community. In Chicago, in Philadelphia, in New York, in Miami, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in San Jose. I can keep going. It's a lot of cities. In Dallas, in Houston, in Kansas City, in St. Louis, because these figures are identical in every urban environment where you find black people and white folks living together. Now, I say living together loosely because it's still segregated in all of these cities. There are still neighborhoods that are 99% black, and there's still neighborhoods that are 99% white. Now, it gets worse. These people are impoverished by the use of drugs. Now, I get asked the question, what about the violence, man? Isn't it justifiable to treat the violent offenders differently than it is to treat the nonviolent offenders? Well, when I hear that question, I understand that the questioner does not know why drug dealing is violent in the poor black neighborhoods and in the poor Latino neighborhoods, and it's nonviolent everywhere else. It's called economics. Real simple analysis. Please tell all your ignorant friends. Now, your friends aren't ignorant because they're bad people. They're ignorant because they're ignorant. I don't get mad at ignorance. I get frustrated. And I see an opportunity because when you give people the missing facts, you get a different response. Their defenses are not prepared for the missing facts, unless, of course, you're working for George Bush. And we have an expression in the practice of law, watch out so you don't get fucked by the missing fact. One fact can change the whole picture. All right, so what's the missing fact in this analysis? It's real simple. Black folks in these urban environments, and you can talk about a certain group of black people homogeneously without a loss of accuracy. Sad but true. So let's do that together. Black folks in these urban environments are buying drugs by the dose. Think of alcohol. It's ordinary for everybody in this room. When you want to drink some liquor, you buy at least a fifth, or you buy a case of beer, right? You don't be running in the street every time you want to drink to buy a little shorty, right? You don't be running to the bar to get your 15-cent glass of beer unless you're really down and out. Well, guess what drug addiction has done to the black community? It's created a bunch of people that are so down and out. Because nothing productive comes from buying drugs the way black people buy drugs and being addicted the way black people are addicted. And so you have this group of people who buy by the dose. That creates tremendous street traffic. The only two models that work to service this economic opportunity. One is called a store. Well, the last drug dealer that started the store has a big sign called stupid up in front of him. Because you lose your inventory, this, that, and the other. It's just not the way it's done. So an elegant model has developed in the black community, which is impossible for the police forces of America to crack. No pun intended. It's real simple. There's a guy on a street corner who has no money and has no drugs. He takes the order from the customer for the one dose or the two doses. He's protected by a guy all the way up a block away and by a guy in the middle of the block. And they use sneaker net to communicate. Not the internet, sneaker net. There's one on the east, one on the west, one on the south. Watch how it works. Guy comes up, he wants a bag of dope or he wants a cap. I'll use the vernacular that I'm used to. The guy on the corner with no money, no drugs, gives a signal to a runner. The runner goes to a moving stash. The stash moves every 15, 20 minutes. So snitches cannot tip off the cops. A second guy, actually the third guy, takes the order and runs from a different direction to the corner, gives it to the customer in return for the money, and disappears. You bust that if you can. Here's how it gets done in urban America. A, in all cities in urban America, the police are predominantly white. There are two reasons from that: historical racism and the reluctance of more and more black people to get involved in police forcing because they know what it means. Nobody in Baltimore, Maryland trusts the cops if you're black. Nobody believes for a minute they don't lie. Nobody likes cops in the black community in Baltimore, Maryland. They have an ambivalent relationship to cops. They need the cops desperately because of the violence I'm getting ready to explain. But they don't trust them for a minute because they see everybody and his mama getting their ass whipped. You know, there's not a black person in urban America who hasn't had either been the victim of police brutality, seen it with his own eyes, or had close friends or relatives who were victimized by police brutality. Likewise, false arrests. Four times for me. Four times. And I is legit. Now, back up for a minute. We go back to the street corner. White man comes in one of these funny-looking cars that even a third grader can make as a cop car. Doesn't belong in the community. The word goes out, 5-0. That's because we used to watch Hawaii 5-0. And it means cop. So 5-0 goes to the intermediate spotter who says 5-0. All of a sudden, all activity ceases. It's a universal language, 5-0. Everybody just twiddles their thumbs, waits for the intruder to come in, holds their breath, because the only way anybody gets busted is by police perjury, which is alive and well. And when the rollers, which is another way to call them because they use squad cars ever since the 60s, and there's a considerable body of opinion that said that that was the last straw that signaled the death knell between accurate policing and what we call abstract policing. Accurate policing is where a foot patrolman knows which member of the family is fucked up and targets him and he leaves the good people in that family alone. Community policing is where you get to know the neighborhood. You know the people on a first-name basis. You are part of the fabric of that community. But when we had squad cars, all you do in the squad cars go from one group of bad people to another group of bad people. And after a while, your view of the world changes. Instead of understanding what's going on in the intimate fabric of that community, you begin to see everybody as a potential criminal. You don't know who you're dealing with when you run up on a family or a community. And so you presume danger to be everywhere, and you act accordingly. Then the community responds in kind. They see you thinking they're dangerous, They recognize that makes you dangerous. And so there is a hatred that forms between motorized police, rollers, as we call them, and the community. Now let's segue back to the corner. So the drug network has collapsed. But that's not good enough for the roller. He's got some statistics that he's getting pressured by the mayor of Baltimore to make. And by the way, last year it is estimated that 120,000. This is no exaggeration. It's becoming an issue in the governor's race. 120,000 black people in Baltimore were arrested without probable cause. Oh, yeah, we got the statistics. All the shit gets cleaned up after the arrest because this is corner cleaning. This is satisfying the outcry in the neighborhood against the violence and the domination of the corners by drug dealers. It's politically expedient. So, backing up, he cleans the corner. He busts all these people. He's got bupkis. He knows he's got bupkis. And so he supplies some real evidence. Of course, it's fictitious, but it becomes real in the courtroom where he is the only credible person who will testify at the proceeding. Because one thing a white cop knows, and a black cop, is that compared to any denizen of the black community, he has the inherent credibility. There aren't judges who are going to disbelieve this cop. Look what's at stake if they do. The cop then gets taken out of service. All the money involved in his training goes down the drain. And so those who understand the deal don't call the cops perjurers. That's just an invitation to political disaster if you're a judge. Happened to my father. He started calling it as he saw it when he got elected judge in 1970. The whole political establishment came down on him. Older black judge whispered and said, look, Murph, don't call them liars. Just say you find the defense evidence more credible. And that will calm it all down because then everybody can go about their business. The cop can stay in service. Nobody has to deal with the ugly little secret of police perjury, which dominates in the black community. And the show goes on. Back to the corner. What's happening there? It's a geographic. I know I'm excited, but damn, I didn't mean to break the glasses. Shit. It's a geographic model that relies on control to work. What goes along with this control? What are the incidental benefits? Well, first of all, everybody's armed. Why are they armed? The only way you compete against this model is face to face. Competition is an inherent part of the human psyche. Territorial defense is an inherent part of every animal in the world. So now you've got guys who are in control of their geographic distribution. It's primarily physically based. And the only way they can compete is face to face. I'm sorry, that causes violence. Let's segue into the white community. I'm a veteran of the white community. Been there many times. Happen to live there now. Know what's going on there, down to the breakfast level. Kellogg's Corn Flakes, the whole thing. I know it, okay? I know how white folks use drugs. I know how they get drugs. Here's what y'all do. You place a call. The economics of your order permit neighborhood delivery. It's kind of like pizza, you know what I mean? And if your economics don't permit it, since you don't have that corner culture to deal with, you just pool your dollars with a group of friends, and now your economics justify home delivery or neutral third place delivery out of the prying eyes of the police forces of the world. So it could be a bar, it could be a friend's house, it could be a car, it can be almost anywhere. And guess what? to bust that requires real policing, doesn't it? Now, it requires wiretaps, surveillance, you know, all the kind of things that police are supposed to be doing. And unlike the black community, they don't know who they're getting ready to bust. It could be a senator's daughter, a mayor's son, or somebody else who can fuck that cop up so badly that he gets scared. And so, unlike this model where you are dealing with these black people of virtually zero credibility in the criminal justice system, and that's regardless of educational attainment, that's regardless of your economics, that's regardless of anything other than your color, you are now a nigger in the courtroom. I've been there. I know what it's like. I've defended so many so-called niggers in the courtroom. I know I got to do some extra stuff to win. I can't base it on he said, she said. My clients will never have inherent credibility in this system. But now we got all of these people of potential, inherently higher credibility than a lowly ass, underclass, poorly educated cop. Oh, the white community abounds with people of higher levels of credibility than that. Now we got a cop that's got to be real careful who he busts. And that's what we call the Grateful Dead phenomenon. Everybody knows the Grateful Dead was a drug band, is a drug band, always will be, in whatever iteration. It gets followed by druggies. The drugs are a virtual cornucopia of possibility. You can get whippets. Didn't know about a whippet until I started integrating. You can get all kind of shrooms. You can get the LSD. You can get the mescaline. You can get everything. You can get it packaged any kind of way you want. It can be in a brownie. It can be in a cupcake. It can be in a drink. It can be any kind of way you want. And everybody plays let's pretend, and the cops are nowhere to be found. And to the extent that they're around in this three-day drug fair that occurs before every Grateful Dead concert on the open parking lot. On the open parking lot. Now, how the fuck do you hide gas? Tanks of gas. How does this go on? And you want to talk about a black man getting mad when he found out about this kind of shit? Oh, my Lord. Because I know what would happen if this was a bunch of black people doing this shit. Okay? Then you go to the concert. Everybody's blind as a bat. You can't walk down the hall without getting a contact high. People bumping into you, they so blind. I'm telling you what I saw. I called my son. I said, Seth, you ain't gonna believe what white folks is doing with drugs, brother. Tim. And then I started looking around at the whole thing. Y'all getting the pass. You ain't being niggerized. You're not being niggerized. Now, back to that street corner and that violence and that comparative analysis of competition. Among white drug dealers, there is very little face-to-face competition. If you decide to change suppliers, your old supplier only knows you don't come to him anymore. He doesn't know who your new supplier is. That doesn't produce gunplay. He doesn't usually carry a gun with him when he's making the delivery because nobody knows. He doesn't worry about being interdicted. Look at the numbers. 80% of all drug users in America are white. It stands to reason because black people so broke, we can't finance Colombia's economy. How the fuck do we deal with Peru and shit? Come on, where's the money coming from? Now, if you look at raw arrests, 80% of the drug dealers getting arrested are white. But when you look at incarceration, there's a 7 times higher likelihood if you're black that you're going to jail. There's a 10 times higher likelihood that your case will progress from arrest to prosecution. And on, the numbers are grim. The numbers are grim. Now, what's happening in the black community? You now understand why violence doesn't accompany your model except at the highest levels of delivery, like in Colombia itself, or when the huge shipments come in. You understand why it's endemic in the black community. What's left to understand? I'll tell you what's left. The devastation that that's causing in the black community, where we don't have a therapeutic model for dealing with drugs like you do. When somebody goes down who's in the workforce in the white community, the first step is forgiveness. Oh, man, I know you got a problem. Stems right out of the experience with alcohol. All the 12-step programs come from alcohol. All the therapeutic models come from alcohol. The forgiveness to a drunk comes from alcohol. You know, you don't want to take a drunk out of the workforce if he's productive. You just want him to stop drinking. This is a rational thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But now let's make it narcotics. First of all, it's secret. The law protects people who get treatment. You don't have to turn them into the cops. You don't have to rat them out. Because if they get treatment, it's protected under Title 19. It's confidential. You can't even subpoena treatment records in criminal cases without it causing a tremendous flap. And so if you refer, if you start out caring about the person as a full-fledged human being who's productive, you don't want him to go down because he used a little pot or he used some cocaine or he got caught with some LSD. Look at his record, man. The guy's producing. Let's save Joe. You look at Joe's family. You say, we don't want to fuck Joe's family up. Incarceration is not usually even an option. Calling the cops, not usually an option. Plus, there's so much red tape if you call the cops. So the guy gets put in treatment. Treatment's always available for white people. He gets treated, gets reintegrated. No harm, no foul. Usually nothing comes of it. Not even an entry on his personnel record. We don't want to fuck Joe up. Putting that on his record. All kinds of liability issues arise out of that if we criminalize him or we put on his record that he's a drug guy. Our insurance rates may go up. But now enter the nigger. He isn't wanted there in the first place. Now, I generalize. It depends on the workforce. How many racists are there? But there are always some. And some had to have a nasty habit of being your immediate supervisor. Let's say one out of five is a racist, which doesn't square with any of the survey data that we've been collecting for the last 25 years. That's why I'm so happy. See, you rarely see white folks confessing about racism in America. That's why I like this guy. See, I like this guy right away when he talk about how racist the shit is. Man, I go to conference after conference after conference, and I hear all these people in denial, just in fucking denial. They don't snitch out the racism in the white society. They don't call people on it. They just say, oh, that's terrible, and walk away. If they say that, here's a man making you confront it. I know he's going to have a hard time because it's so deeply entrenched. So now look at the reaction to the black employee. He gets fired. Oh, we can't have that. That's contradictory to our company policy. It's inimical to the way we do business. You know this. You see our anti-drug policy. We gave it to you when you came in the door. Fuck you. You're gone. Now the guy's unemployable. It's on his personnel record. The next employer, what the hell is he going to do? Is he going to hire this guy and face increased liability? No. Am I going to hire the guy in my law firm? I tried that shit. I did. I tried it. Two lawyers went down, drug addicts. Bam. Should have listened to the rumors. They were coked out. They had to go. Because you're not going to fuck with me like that. I'm sorry. This is too serious what we doing. Secretaries. I thought you knew about her. What do you mean? Well, the word on her was that she was a heroin addict when you hired her. Well, that's not the reference we got from Pipe and Marbury, that great law firm. It's some true shit. All right? They got rid of her, but they ain't gonna tell you why. Where does that leave us? It leaves us with no debate emanating from the black community. I don't know a single black elected official who is willing to stand up and say this is bullshit because he is scared of the white response. He's not scared of the black response. He is scared that the newspaper's going to be all over him because what newspapers do you know daily-wise have come out in favor of even a debate over this, whether they ought to be prohibition or not? Why can't we even get it to the level of a debate? And everybody who has dared to stick their little toe into this business of questioning prohibition has been knocked down. Look at Kurt Schmoke, my former mayor. Became a pariah overnight. Here's a guy who should have been a federal judge, should have been head of a major federal agency. But as soon as he said the L word, his political future went down the fucking drain. Black people see that. They see you can't get federal funds standing up asking for legalization. They see you can't run for public office asking for legalization. You can't even get news time asking for legalization. You can't get anybody willing to stand up next to you if you're asking for legalization. So there's no debate. And since we're the only ones going to jail, essentially, nobody's outraged in the majority community about these draconian jail sentences where for 5 grams of crack, not even enough to keep a crack addict high for a day, you get a mandatory minimum of 5 years, no parole in a federal penitentiary. And then for 10 grams, you get a mandatory minimum, no, 50 grams rather, you get a mandatory minimum of 10 years. And that's not enough to keep a crack addict in crack for 3 days. And it's all based on the fiction that black people are too stupid to buy in quantities for personal use. Too stupid to buy more than a day's supply. Too stupid to buy a day's supply. Smart enough only to buy a rock. And so it's gone from an imperative caused by poverty to absolute stupidity. Black people, let's face it, they just stupid like that. If you got 50 grams of cocaine on you, you just a dumb nigga. That's all you are. You weren't smart enough. You didn't have the intelligence enough to buy for more than one day or one dose. That's where we are. That's where we are. Now, bear in mind, I'm mad, but I ain't mad with you. Let's understand that. I'm pissed off like a motherfucker, but I'm not pissed off at you. You're on the right side of this. That's why I came. You're on the right side of this. I'm proud to know you. It takes courage to do what you're doing. It takes courage to stand up to legislatures across the country and to the President of the United States, who has got to be regarded as the lowest level leader we have ever had among the civilized people of the world. Yeah. I've been on some of these presidents' lists. I was on one of Nixon's lesser lists. I won the biggest bank robbery case in the history of the United States. It was $547,000 stolen by two Negroes. The FBI couldn't find the money. And so they responded by offering me $50,000 through a black lawyer. He came to me. I said, motherfucker, get out of my face. You crazy? He was. He went back and told the FBI I was crazy for not taking the 50 grand. The FBI felt no shame, and they came to me and offered me the 50 grand directly. I said, you criminal motherfuckers, everything we've been thinking about you is absolutely true. And he said, well, what the fuck? Are you going to take the money or not? And when I didn't take the money and they couldn't find the dough, and you can imagine where that J. Gould was calling. You stupid white people. You're the stupidest white people. You're going to let some niggers keep this money from you? I'll sentence you to Lower Slobovia in Alaska or wherever the fuck I can put you. And that was the way he was. And so these guys were under tremendous pressure. And then finally, we made a deal. We gave them back $150,000 of the money. And then they lied and said they got it all back. And it was such a bad lie that a black reporter figured it out. And since they think all black people talk to each other, they figured I had tipped this guy off. Next thing I know, two agents from the IRS, two special agents, come in, flash their badges. I've been practicing for 3 years at this time. And they gave me my Miranda rights. Oh, yeah. I said, what's this all about? We asked the questions, not you. I said, well, if you don't start asking my question about what the fuck this is all about, there's the motherfucking door. And that's where they went. And for 3 years, I was under active criminal investigation. They went to every client I had ever had, and some I didn't realize that I had. They got the receipts or the oral testimony about how much money each had given to me. They matched it up carefully with my last 3 years' income tax returns. Guess what? I was clean. They ain't have anything on me because my daddy had warned me. He said, son, you got a big mouth. They're coming after you. You bend over in the shower, brother. It's not going to be a pleasant experience. And so I speak to you with partially afraid. I know what these motherfuckers do. I know how they use pretext. I know how they deal with you all. As soon as you get the big A on your back, activists, they start looking in all kinds of hidden places, don't they? Trying to fuck you up on a technicality. They don't want to deal with your message. They want to put you out of service. They hope they can find you smoking some weed in all the wrong places. They hope that they can find you compromised so that instead of making this movement stronger, you'll be another casualty of the so-called war on drugs, which is really a war on black people. Now, last but not least, let me just say this. Black women can't find a man. Can't find a man. Most of their men have criminal records. When I say most, it's approaching 80%. If they're not under active probation, they're actually in jail. Upwards of 75% are either on active probation or in jail. Now, what happens when they go to jail? If you watch Oz, you see they get butt-fucked forcibly by men without condoms. And in my state, condoms are prohibited in jails because they encourage homosexuality. Oh, yeah, this is some true shit. And so if you go in with a 20% AIDS rate, you come out with a considerably higher AIDS rate. And since most men submit consensually after 2 years of incarceration, and most women submit consensually after about 7 months of incarceration, you got a whole lot of sex going on in the prisons. Deal with it like we deal with it. Here's how we deal with it. It's called being on the down low. You heard black women talk about they can't tell the right-handed hitters from the switch hitters or the left-handed hitters? They mean that. Now, I'm not against any kind of hitting. You hit the way you want to hit. But at least give the woman the choice. Tell her what kind of hitting you're doing. And so we're inundated now. We see for the first time black homosexual gangs. We never saw that because there was a shame level associated with being gay that's no longer there. We see this rise of transvestism. It is the fastest growing form of sexual fetishism in the world. Men acting like women. Men acting like women trapped in men's bodies. I wonder where this is coming from. Well, when you start asking a few of them, you know where it's coming from. Prison. Now look at the health care costs. Because the fastest growing group of women in the United States who are HIV positive are not the ones who are using needles. They're heterosexual women. It's been true for the last 4 years. Heterosexual black women. Where are they getting this infection from? Men who are pretending to be heterosexual exclusively, who are coming from jail. Where are we going? Look at how many men are disenfranchised who can no longer vote. It's upwards of 20%. This is solving a lot of political problems for those remaining racists in America who want to take back control of the city. This is an agenda which is working. Look at the death rates that are rising out of this. They're extraordinary. The public health professionals project that at the rate of death in the black community, from drug-related crimes or from outright medical problems that are going untreated, black people's birth rates are approaching negative numbers for the first time in the history of America. Never thought I'd see that. In other words, what we're seeing, whether it started out that way or not, is genocide. What is genocide? Genocide is when you deliberately do something that causes the death and destruction of a people because of their classification. That's genocide. Now, let's assume it didn't start out intentional. All of you can see what's happening, right? You can see it. Once you can see it, what do you call it then? Let's say you can see it for a year and nothing gets done. What do you call it then? Or let's say you can see it for 2 years, nothing gets done. What do you call it then? What if you can see it for 5 years, nothing gets done? War on drugs was declared almost 40 years ago. We are in our 40th year of this approach to the black community. I'm not mad with you, but I'm mad as hell. We need your help. And we can't do this by looking at things from a narrow political calculus at the expense of all these suffering people. We got to be forthright about this shit. I know the first thing that'll happen when we legalize, the violence will end. That's good enough for me. I know the second thing that'll happen is people will live in neighborhoods in the black community instead of armed camps where everybody's getting the hell out who can afford to get out. And the only remaining citizens in the inner cities of the black community are those who are too poor to move. I remember my day of reckoning. I was committed to be a settler in my own community, working for the benefit of the community, until the third burglary by my next door neighbor's son. And I said, I got to protect my kids. It's okay if I'm a single man, I can put up with this. And then when you look at the schools where you got to go, if you committed to the public schools, it's horrible. In our high school named after Frederick Douglass, 14% of the freshmen graduate. 14%. So, I'm done. I could go on. I'm done. I thank you for being patient with me, both because of the length of my remarks, the passion of my remarks, and because of the sudden ending of my remarks.
I don't know about you, but how would you like to have to slip a 3-minute warning in front of this guy? as build, it was rousing, inspiring, and very, very instructive. I want to mention two websites in case you are interested in following up on my organization, LEAP. We are at leap.cc, leap.cc. Please visit that website. If you're inclined to support us, become a friend of LEAP. Friends of LEAP, understand that there are no meetings and no dues, but you add to our numbers and to the strength of our argument if you are interested. If you have an interest in purchasing my book, and of course I hope you do, please know that you can access Amazon.com through my website, which gives me something like a nickel on the book, which I donate to domestic violence sexual assault services. The website is normstamper.com. And in that book, just by way of summarizing my final remarks, there is a chapter entitled Racism in the Ranks, which is apropos of what is happening from a police administrator's point of view in policing across this country, reinforced entirely by what Billy has been talking about. And there is another chapter entitled Why White Cops Kill Black Men. It is a given that Amadou Diallo would be alive today if he were white, that Abner Louima would not have been tortured had he been white, that Rodney King would not have been beaten senseless had he been white. Whether it's drugs and drug enforcement or any other occasion that brings white police officers together with black men, we see only rare positive outcomes. It is systematic. It is as disturbing as it is common. And it is predicated, in my judgment, on fear. The fear of white men, of black men. And all I can tell you is that whether it's racism, sexism, homophobia, or any other brand of bigotry, it is fear and ignorance that produces that. And so I just want to say once again how deeply I am indebted to you, Billy, for your talk this morning. Deborah, thank you.